This is a review of a document that was prepared by Power Projects on behalf of our tier for ECA last year, and it's only just become available. It's a review of the issues and options with regard to whether we require an allocation regime for marine energy. So New Zealand has space and resource allocation regimes for most energy sources in New Zealand, and it also has space allocation regimes for other marine resources such as marine reserves, fishing quota and aquaculture, but it doesn't have one for marine energy. And marine energy does occur within the Crown Estate, so access to presently to space and resources is via the RMA and its amendments. And the RMA is really a piece of environmental legislation. It operates on a first-come, first-served basis. It's probably satisfactory now, but in the longer term, we need to discuss whether it will be. So this is work done in the second quarter of 2009. It was peer-reviewed by a legal expert in the RMA in late 2009, and it's just been published on the ECA website, and we've put it on the AOTEA website as well as a discussion document for consideration by the industry. So the contents are marine energy in New Zealand, the current allocation regime for marine energy, allocation regimes in New Zealand for other space and resources, and then a review of the international allocation regimes for marine energy, because there are some countries that have them, and some ideas on a design for a space and resource allocation regime if we were to decide to have one. Just want to point out that 21st century New Zealand, this is the exclusive economic zone around New Zealand is the pink area. The green area is the extended continental shelf outer limits. That's also part of our exclusive economic zone, or extended continental shelf as it's called. 94% of the surface area of New Zealand is actually ocean, not land. Only 6%, the traditional upside-down map of Italy, is actually land. And we have the 10th longest coastline in the world. Canada has the longest by about 250,000 kilometres, but New Zealand has the 10th longest coastline in the world. And I don't know whether you know, but we're actually the fourth largest country in the world as a result of the extension of our exclusive economic zone. So we have a large area to play with, but unfortunately our resources for marine energy are quite a lot more restricted. And this is a map that was produced by MetOcean Solutions in a project I did with them 2 years ago to look at the distribution of wave and tidal energy resources. And you can see that with respect to tidal resources, there are actually very few sites. The brighter colours, the reddier colours, are the areas where there are reasonable tidal resources. And possibly Fovo Strait on the south side of Stewart Island, possibly around the end of Banks Peninsula, possibly Cape Reinga, although you're a long way from any market or any connection, and most obviously around Cook Strait. I think it's likely we're not going to see harbour barrages in New Zealand because of the environmental problems. We have very sediment-laden rivers, and so I think we're more likely to see tidal stream projects. And I think we may see an expansion into the open sea and away from the five major harbours down the west coast of the North Island eventually. Since submarine costs cables are a key cost, about 30 to 40% of a marine offshore project will be the cables. I think we're likely to see sites develop near shore, which will eventually migrate offshore. If you look at Cook Strait in a bit more detail, that's from the same reports available on the AOTEA website and on the ECA website and the Electricity Commission website. You can see that in fact the area, the orange area, which is the area of potential resources above 2 metres per second, is even more restrictive than it appeared in the first map. The location you can see at the bottom, there's some detail on those five. That's not my map. We've lost something from the wave diagram. I'll just try and go back. I'm not sure what's going on, but this is the map for waves. Anything where you're turning from pale blue to yellow is the start of reasonable potential for wave resources greater than 2 meters. Greater than 2 meter wave height. You can see the wave resources are much more widely distributed, particularly around the southern part of the western and southern coasts of the north and of the South Island and the west coast of the North Island. On the northern coasts, the wave energy is about a quarter of what it is on the western coast. Again, we're likely to see projects. I think they will gradually move offshore as a result of the fact that we've got cables as a key cost. So there may still be pressure even for wave projects, and there certainly will be for tidal stream projects. And the pressure for space will probably be, for wave energy, will probably be caused by proximity to facilities, that is, export facilities or connections to the grid and to markets. Ownership of the offshore space is vested, and responsibility for management of offshore space is vested in the Crown. In the absence of a specific allocation regime, access to space and resources is allocated by the two territorial authorities, regional councils and district councils, and some unitary authorities through the RMA. As I've said, the RMA operates on first-come, first-served basis and is concerned with the sustainable management of natural and physical resources. It doesn't offer central government any strategic control over how things are developed, and territorial authorities can't consider trade competition issues. So most regional plans do not yet make provisions for marine energy, but some, like Wellington and Waikato, and there are people from both of those regional councils here, are beginning to recognise the potential and include it in their plans. If we look at the choice of an allocation regime, you can see, and these are covered in much more detail in the report, oil and gas is a nationalised resource. I'll come back to that a bit later on. In the onshore, I should have split that up, in the onshore, access to space and surface is usually private. In the offshore, it's obviously controlled by the Crown. Similarly with coal, that's a nationalised resource, and access is usually on private land, so you have to negotiate with two parties. Geothermal ownership is largely private, and access to the space is usually private as well. Wind, as you know, nobody owns the wind, it's a public resource, but access to the space is usually a private arrangement between the project developer and the landowner. But the two that I would like to focus on are aquaculture. Aquaculture is a public resource, and access to the space in the open ocean is public, and the same is true for ocean energy. Allocation of marine resources is clearly a Crown responsibility, and in my view, at some point in the future, there's a need for considering strategic allocation once we get sufficient marine energy projects in the water. The reason why I argue that it would be useful to have an allocation regime is aquaculture is a very good example of how not to do it. Aquaculture space was granted under the RMA, but during the 1990s grew very rapidly with a huge backlog of applications and increasing concern about the cumulative effects. So governments introduced a moratorium in 2001. And then amended the RMA in 2005 to include aquaculture. A new marine farm proposal must now be within what are called aquaculture management areas. And I'll pass over some of the details, but the benefits for the community ought to be that space available for marine farms is now identified, ad hoc decisions about allocation are avoided, and effective parties can comment on the regional coastal plan in the area that they're interested in, or where an application has been made. What happens is that marine farm developers now get authority from a territorial authority to establish an aquaculture management area via competitive tendering. You still need to get a consent under the RMA, so it's a separate process from the environmental process. And authorisations are only valid for 2 years, but can be sold or traded in that time. and any competitive tender money split between the territorial authority and the Crown to do research and development work. Ministers of Conservation and Fisheries, just as they do with marine energy now, have some authority over what happens, and the outcomes are that, however, and I'm not suggesting this is good, is that since the AMAs were introduced, I believe I'm still correct in saying no new space has been allocated. Not a single aquaculture development has been put in place since the moratorium in 2001. And that's led to a loss of investor confidence, a loss of capital value, and a flight of investment capital overseas. So I would argue that the aquaculture open model isn't a good one for the marine energy industry. A better model might be oil and gas. Oil and gas was nationalised by the Oil Petroleum Act in 1937, which gave the Crown allocative rights, and the Crown is responsible for efficient allocation of rights to prospect, explore and mine petroleum, and that's set out in the Crown Minerals Act of 1991, section 12 of which provides for policies, procedures and provisions for management of Crown minerals, efficient allocation of rights. And there's a discussion in the document on what efficient allocation is, and the Crown to receive a fair financial return via royalties for petroleum extracted. The permit types that are available are non-exclusive prospecting permits, exclusive exploration and mining permits, and I suppose we might look at something similar for ocean energy. The allocation methods are either by competitive bidding, through licensing rounds, priority in time applications, which is another competitive bidding process, and people acquiring existing permits. In the UK, there has been a simplification of the allocation process for marine energy. They've tried to create what they call a one-stop shop for projects wanting to develop marine energy in UK waters, but there is still a problem because there are five devolved administrations in the UK, Northern Ireland, Wales, England, Scotland, sorry, four, and there's also a legislative boundary change at the 12 nautical mile limit, and also changes at projects greater than 100 or less than 100 megawatts, which are regarded above 100 megawatts, they're regarded as nationally significant and handled differently. In New Zealand, we have one piece of legislation, the RMA, but we have 12 regional councils and five unitary authorities administering them, the UK, permitting. You're probably aware that the Crown Estate in the UK, or the Marine Estate in the UK, which is part of the Crown Estate, which owns 50% of the Scottish foreshore out to the 12 nautical mile limit and has rights to natural resources out to the edge of the EEZ, which is 200 nautical miles in the UK. It's held two licensing rounds for offshore wind, and I believe there's a third one in progress at the moment, and it gazetted its first marine energy licensing round in October 2008. It was a complex process with requiring expressions of interest and invitations to develop full proposals. And in 2009, the Crown Estate announced that it would match developers' option fees, because they pay to propose a project. With those funds, the two sets of funds from the developers and the Crown Estates, matching funds going to R&D. 42 applications were received, and on March the 16th, in other words, just over a month ago, 10 permits were awarded to seven developers for projects totaling 1,200 megawatts, enough to power 750,000 homes. So in terms of design considerations for a regime, we need to look at allocative efficiency, what is the greatest value creation, and if I can offer a model for comparison, which is discussed in the report, water resources in the South Island are going through exactly the same problem that aquaculture is going through. And the Business Council for Sustainable Development came up with a very nice proposal for dealing with ensuring greatest value creation. So I'd encourage you to have a look at the report and have a look at how that might apply to ocean energy. Allocation costs are likely to fall to the developer. That's how governments make it work. And so in our view, pre-commercial projects will require additional support, and I would count almost every project in New Zealand as a pre-commercial project for that particular kind of thing. The Crown needs to receive a fair financial return for the resources that it allows to be exploited, and New Zealand ought to remain an attractive investment target for marine energy developers. And lastly, continuity of the onshore legislation into the offshore. I believe that some of the current discontinuities could be eliminated. And at the bottom is a table just showing how projects might mature from single prototypes through to commercial arrays and the implications for a consenting process to allow that to happen. And then just finally, four objectives that we believe ought to be borne in mind. One, we'd like to see a separation of marine energy from other marine uses, because we believe that competition, or hope that competition for marine energy space and resources is likely to develop very fast. We'd like to see some consideration of strategic planning versus a pure market allocation regime. And that would require a central agency rather than regional councils. The government's just established an environmental protection agency, the EPA, but that would not be the appropriate agency to be managing allocation for energy. And environmental impacts still need to be addressed under the RMA, but we would like to see some strategic environmental assessments. I'll come to that in the next slide. And then a simplification of, where possible, of some of the regulatory authority requirements. So maybe a sum of EPA to become a one-stop shop for both allocation and consent, which will operate over both the coastal marine area, which is 12 nautical miles, and beyond that in the exclusive economic zone, moving eventually to marine spatial planning in future. Then lastly, just some supporting concepts to that. We need an online atlas. Mike Underhill mentioned that in his presentation this morning, and there is a proposal in the current version of the energy strategy, which is under review, for an online atlas to be produced by the end of 2009. It didn't happen. And we'd like to propose strategic environmental assessments to identify as areas of interest and concern for marine energy development. Most West European countries have done strategic environmental assessments, and they are helping to promote marine energy projects. We'd like to see separate treatment for marine energy prototype projects in a low-cost fast-track process. The US Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and Marine and Minerals Management Service have developed a low-cost fast-track process for prototype projects, and a one-stop shop I've already mentioned. And I'll pass over, we need a strategy for the development of marine energy. There isn't one at the moment, and I believe that there's a need for a national allocation regime, but that's open for discussion. Thank you very much.